Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. How are you doing? It's a beautiful day out there. Sunny day. That's how we like it. Thank you, Dan. Kristen Davis here with me from Southern Environmental Law Center. Sunny day, beautiful day. Is that all thanks to the Southern Environmental Law Center?
I wish I could say it was, but it's a beautiful day without our involvement. Sure is welcome, though.
It sure is welcome. Well, that's how it should be. And you're taking you're not taking all the grace for that?
No. No, we do what we can, but can't make the sun shine.
But you make the flowers grow, and the water water clear and crisp.
We are definitely working to make sure all of that keeps happening here. I spend a lot of my time focused on clean water in Virginia, and we are focused on clean air and protecting all our natural resources throughout the Southeast.
Southern Environmental Law Center is here. Kristen Davis here today to talk about fracking. Will Cleveland on his way to talk about solar energy and uranium mining. That's our hour. Thank you for tuning in to 94.7 WPVC.
You're the button.
That's okay. Kristen, as the guest in the studio, talk a little bit about Southern Environmental Law Center. Because I think, you know, people say that all the time. Oh, the SELC, the Southern Environmental Law Center. People, especially those listening to WPVC, interested in environmental issues. What is the SELC?
Sure.
Give them some background.
Absolutely. So the Southern Environmental Law Center, we're a nonprofit organization. We've got headquarters in Charlottesville. So we've got an office here with about, I would say, 12... lawyers now in Charlottesville focused on Virginia issues. We've got offices in North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Tennessee, Alabama, and also in Washington, D.C., which is an office that's very busy these days. We've got about 60 lawyers total, and then all kinds of folks helping us with communications and other work.
Federal funding?
No federal funding. Nonprofit, we rely on generous donors throughout the Southeast, and I think throughout the country and world even, to support our work, as well as grants and institutions, foundations, but not federal funding.
Which is thankful these days, because a lot of federal funding projects are getting cut.
That's correct. There's a lot of changes, of course, going on with the federal government. We don't know how all of it's going to play out, but we are very glad for the support coming from people who want us to keep doing our important work working at the local state level, and we'll keep working at the federal level.
Thank you for the work you do.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
All right. So Kristen Davis here with us today on the Sunday morning wake-up call. Kristen is an attorney from the Southern Environmental Law Center. She will be talking today about fracking. Hydraulic fracking is its official name, correct?
Yes. Hydraulic fracturing, fracking, high-volume hydraulic fracturing. Generally, it's all the same, but generally we all just stick with the shorthand fracking. One thing that's really interesting to note about it, something that plays out a lot in the media and in our legal issues, is the public, you know, we hear fracking and we think of the entire shebang, the whole drilling development process. Fracturing is actually one stage of the process where they, they break up the rock so that gas can escape from it. But most folks, when they think of it, are talking about drilling, fracturing the rock, and gas development in general.
But natural gas is one of the cleaner alternative fuels, correct? I mean, that's when people talk about getting away from coal. natural gas is in the good side of the checklist.
I think it was considered on the better side of the checklist. It's still a fossil fuel, and increasingly the science is showing that the methane impacts and other impacts of natural gas don't make it a dream fuel for us. Perhaps it's a bridge fuel, but there's certainly much cleaner renewable energies out there.
How long did it take for people to decide that it didn't, that it fell into the bridge source instead of just on the good side?
I think, at least I know from my perspective, it was always viewed as a bridge, that we can do better than fossil fuels with renewables. And then the science is always evolving. The more we use something, the more we learn about it, which is great. And we want to make sure that we're continuing to use facts and science in that way with not just this, but all of the issues that we cover.
11:05 here on the Sunday morning wake-up call. Our guest this morning, Attorney Kristen Davis from the Southern Environmental Law Source, Charlottesville office. Thank you so much for being here and tuning in on what is a beautiful February day. Global warming in play here.
There's definitely global warming going on, but I don't know about our specific weather patterns today or this year.
Hang tight. Nope, that was me. I thought we lost your voice, but I think we just lost my headphone. Keep going. A beautiful February day. Back to fracking, hydraulic fracturing. In 2014, let's go local here. The U.S. Forest Service announced that it was going to place a 1.1 million acre George Washington National Forest off limits for fracturing, correct?
That's right. The Forest Service, about every 10 or 15 years, works on a plan for each forest, and that's going to guide what happens in that forest for the next 10 or 15 years. The Forest Service and lots of interested stakeholders, including SELC, works for many years to arrive at that plan, talking about what they could do, what they're considering, what various folks think they should not do. And for that plan, there was a lot of attention paid to whether or not the Forest Service would make additional available for leasing for gas development. And with a lot of work with SELC and partners in the Valley and throughout Virginia, we are so glad that they decided not to make any additional acres for gas drilling in our beautiful George Washington National Forest.
Could this be changed under the new administration? I mean, it's a federal organization, correct?
The Forest Service is a federal agency. Those plans, they play out according to statute on a time schedule, so you can amend them during. It would require, because of the drastic impacts that would have, environmental impacts, it would require a tremendous amount of environmental analysis to go through. And of course, we do not believe that our national forests are even close to the right place to be drilling for natural gas. GW contains headwaters for drinking water for millions of people on the East Coast, and most of us go out there to enjoy that clean water and trees and nature and not to look at gas wells and pipelines.
But just because you don't believe it and the SELC doesn't believe it, again, I go back to the question that the forests, let me get the name correct again. The U.S. Forest Service is a federal organization. Can't the federal organizations decision be changed by the federal group,
yes,
which has changed dramatically since November?
Policy can definitely change, and they can go through their administrative process to make the changes they want. Luckily, in the U.S., we have NEPA, which is a federal statute, which requires environmental review of these. So it is not as simple as, you know, tearing up one piece of paper and handing over another. That would go through environmental review that involves public input throughout. that typically takes several years when you're looking at a large decision, like a forest plan, and that would have to play out for any amendments related to gas development also.
When you say several years, so I'm asking you to look at this from your most frightened state.
Oh, yeah.
Is this something that is on more than your most back burner?
That particular issue isn't. I mean, I think like so many, maybe you and so many of your listeners, I spend a lot of time very worried about where we're headed. And I spend even more time thinking about what we're going to do to protect what we've achieved and to stem the rollbacks that we fear. This particular issue is not something, you know, I've got a lot to worry about these days. We all do. And this particular issue with the GW is not rising to the top of my list. Thank goodness. We, of course, would be ready to swing into action should that, you know, look like it's on the horizon. We certainly would not be alone. There were just tons and tons of people who were opposed to gas drilling in the National Forest. And we believe, you know, folks are very motivated, very informed, and they would be ready to step up and let their voices be heard if that issue came up anytime soon.
And you... It is, and you say that you're not worried about it because of all the folks who made their voices heard the first time, and so you think that that's what would prevent that from rehappening, from the change being made?
Because of the process we have in place with NEPA and environmental review, that is the structure that lets us, the people, the public, Southern Environmental Law Center, anyone, any citizen, any organization, to weigh in and say, hey, agency, we know you're talking about doing this. Tell us all of the relevant information. Tell us all the environmental review. Tell us how it would impact the rivers in the GW, the rivers downstream, the air. You look at all of that and you put the facts and information out there, and we're going to let you know what we think and whether or not you should do it. And there's a couple of rounds back and forth of that. So I am confident that, you know, we push for science and facts to play into that. And I guess I take solace in that procedure, that we at least have that ability to do it. We worry a lot about, at the federal level, any kind of movement that would restrict that would cut back on our right to weigh in and make sure there's thorough environmental analysis and public input process.
Solace is a word that I've used a lot in the last 4 or 5 months. I'm glad to hear that the 1.1 million acres in the George Washington National Forest still seem off limits to fracking.
Absolutely. Yeah. I would encourage everyone to get out in the forest and enjoy it. It's there for all of us to enjoy, and particularly on a sunny day like this, very tempting.
Kristen Davis here from the Southern Environmental Law Center. We are talking about fracking. Tell me, what prompted you to take on this project?
Sure.
At the SELC?
Yeah, I've been at SELC for 2 years now. I was in private practice for 6 years before that and actually did a fair bit of work on the other side of these issues. So I've been involved with coal companies, natural gas companies. And before that, I grew up in West Virginia, so I'm from coal country. I have been looking at this issue my entire life. It was really a dream come true for me personally to come over to SELC about, 2.5 years ago and immediately get to start working on fracking and natural gas issues in Virginia. There's a lot that can be done, and I'm very happy to say, you know, I know we've all have our down and discouraged moments in the past few months, but we are making a ton of progress on this issue in Virginia, and I think have realistic expectations of more successes.
When you talk about making a lot of progress on this issue in Virginia, how far along in this issue is Virginia, or how much fear of this issue in Virginia is that compared to other states? I mean, I've just never thought of fracking as being an issue compared to other states.
Right.
I mean, there's never been a movie made about the fracking problem in Virginia as there was in Pennsylvania or North Dakota, et cetera.
It's different here, what's been playing out. So Virginia, you know, we've got so many different geographical regions, including our coal fields down in southwestern Virginia. There's a couple of different types of natural gas, and one that we capture and use is coal bed methane. So that is gas that's rather than being trapped in shale, like the Marcellus shale deposits or the Taylorsville Basin shale deposit in Virginia, it is inside coal. So we have for decades been capturing coal bed methane for sale and use in Virginia. And they do use, it's a different fracking than what we've all, I think, have in our minds when we think of modern fracking now. I think most of us have become somewhat familiar with the Marcellus Shale and the movies you're talking about and what that means. And that's they take a whole lot of water, generally water. It could be gas and sometimes, but a whole lot of water, add some chemicals and something, usually sand, injected at a high pressure down into the earth, deep, deep, deep into the earth, into a shale formation, and then inject that into the shale, prop it open with some sand, and by doing that, let the shale gas come out. Down in southwestern Virginia, they've been doing that in coal seams, and it plays out differently. It's not high volume of water that's generally used, but it is fracturing the coal seams to get the coal bed methane. So that's been occurring in Virginia for a long time now. We do have shale deposits. There was, as you just mentioned, there was consideration of allowing drilling and gas development in the GW National Forest, which would be Marcellus shale. That continues over into parts of the Shenandoah Valley. So Western Virginia has that possibility. And there was also, or there is also, the Taylorsville Basin shale deposit, which is over in Chesapeake, Virginia. It's under five counties. Let's see if I can get them. It's King and Queen, King George County, Westmoreland, Caroline, and Essex counties. Starting in about, 2013, we realized that a company had gone and leased over 86,000 acres of gas rights there. So as the gas boom was happening in Pennsylvania and elsewhere, the Marcellus Shale gas boom, there was a very realistic concern that Virginia might be heading towards a similar situation here. That would have been a new type of gas development using high-volume hydraulic fracturing and horizontal drilling. So that particular combo, which is what we see in the movies and we, you know, read new studies about every week they're coming out. So it's not really a hypothetical concern for Virginia. We have the resource and we have interest, and in the right circumstances, there could be gas development.
Is this a greater problem in a more urban area? And I don't mean, when I use the word urban, I'm not talking about a city such as Arlington, Virginia, or Richmond, Virginia. I mean urban being closer to the East Coast rather than being in the coal fields of Virginia or being in the Dakotas.
Sure. Obviously, the East Coast is different from the Midwest in that we're packed in tighter than the big, vast areas out there that are largely unpopulated. As far as urban versus, you know, coal fields of Virginia or even West Virginia, I don't think so. It's an industrial activity. That's one thing we've wanted to make sure. It would have been a new industry for, say, the Taylorsville Basin area. These are folks on the Chesapeake Bay who have relied on the bay and agriculture for their income. So this would have been a new industry. One thing we wanted to make sure people understood is it is industrial activity. You will not have one well that goes in and then you're unaware of it. You'll have, you know, lots of trucks coming through. You'll have infrastructure, compressor stations, and pipelines. In my mind, you know, I come from a rural area and I love rural areas. I think that the impacts can actually be greater when you go into a rural agricultural heavy wooded area like the Taylorsville Basin and so many other areas in Virginia and introduce a new heavy industry. I think the impact there just on the communities, the character, the residents, quality of life is perhaps even higher than in more urban areas.
11:19 here on the Sunday morning wake-up call, talking with Southern Environmental Law Center attorney Kristen Davis about fracking. Hang tight. Back in action with Christine Davis. Christine, you know, people have seen the movies, probably. But we've heard that fracking affects the water. I want to know, you know, we've seen the movie where you turn on your water and then you can put a match near it.
Yeah.
Right.
The old faucet fire scene.
Right. Give me more information on what's really happening here.
Sure.
Is that truth or is that the fiction to get me excited or make me upset?
I think that's a pretty dramatic image, so it works well in the movies. I wish I could say that this was more something that only occurs in the movies. Water contamination from fracking and industrial gas development generally is well documented in the scientific literature. I don't know if you're familiar with EPA did a study that came out in December of 2016, the final report on the impacts of fracking on drinking water. This is a report, it's the most complete compilation to date that we've had of national scientific data. EPA did this because they specifically wanted to provide localities, decision makers, industries, communities with the scientific foundation they needed when they are making decisions about fracking, whether or not to have it in their communities and their states, knowing that they need to protect public health and drinking water resources. This was a very thorough, years-long study. They looked at over 1,200 scientific sources. They got feedback from an independent, peer-reviewed process by their science advisory board. They had stakeholder input, and there was lots of new research being fed into it. And what that study showed is that there are many stages of the fracking process and the gas development process in which water degradation or even total contamination can occur. They identified certain risk factors. Again, their goal was to help communities understand the risks so that they can decide how they want to address them. Some of the examples of risks of focus areas are issues that play out in Virginia and across the nation. For example, there are spills of the fracking fluids and the produced water, so water that's been used in fracking. You can have spills at the surface, which then they can, you
know.
Are
you talking about the waste, the leftover waste?
It can be either. Before they frack, they have to mix those chemicals at the surface. You can have any number of, you know, you can imagine the hose leaked from the truck turned over. So just surface spills, they're generally a result of human error or equipment failure. So you've got that before fracking, and then you've also got what you're talking about, the wastewater, which is it's been used in the process and it's returned to the surface with those chemicals. And often in Virginia, that would be frequently stored in waste pits, which are just pools at the surface, and those can overflow, those can fail. So surface spills is one kind of general area that can lead to water contamination. You can also have contamination from actually injecting those fluids into the wells. So there are some requirements, and this varies state by state, but when you're going to put these fluids into a well to frack the rock, it's at very high pressure. And so you need standards for how much casing, how much cement needs to go around the well to try your best to make sure that it stays within that well. But that doesn't always work. Sometimes it was just, you know, a shoddy job, or sometimes it was old cement. So it just doesn't always work. You've got leaks from an actually poorly constructed or inadequately constructed well. We've also got methane migration. So gas that can, you're opening up these channels underground, and you've got gas that can then move through them and into drinking water. So you've probably heard of folks who smelled gas coming out of their well, or suddenly their well water, you know, was soapy or smelled funny or looked different.
Do we know how far this methane can move? Are we talking about somebody whose home is, you know, next door or within a couple hundred yards of the property? Or are we talking about somebody who's within a couple miles of the property or on the other side of the mountain ridge?
Yeah, it really varies by the specific geology there, how much fracking has been done in the past, what else has happened underground in the past there. So it varies, but we're definitely talking about, you know, it can travel more than hundreds of yards. I think adjacent landowners are certainly, you know, right to worry about their
right. Just because you don't have my gas rights on my property doesn't mean I'm not being affected.
Oh, absolutely. And there are lots of places like that where people have given out, they've leased the mineral rights so that someone can come in and get the gas, but that doesn't mean they're not living on the surface. It doesn't mean that this isn't happening underneath or in close proximity to schools and hospitals and other public buildings. You don't really need a direct link to it to be potentially affected by it.
Let's talk about that for a minute,
Sure. Unless
you've got something else that follows up on that question.
Let's talk about that.
Let's talk about what happens on top of the surface. You mentioned how people need to know about everything that happens. It's not just one well. That's all the infrastructure that goes along with it, all the transportation, all the trucks that come in and out. By the way, 11:26 here on Sunday morning wake up call, Kristen Davis from the Southern Environmental Law Center here talking about fracking today. You said schools, and that's what put me off here on this tangent, is do we have any fracking going on in the state of Virginia yet?
Fracking does occur down in the coal field. So it's different than the high volume hydraulic fracturing that's happening in the Marcellus shale area, but fracking and coal bed methane, yes.
Do we have any studies, or whether they're official studies or we just have observational studies on how it changes kids and what happens to school grades and studies and anything like that?
Let's see. So we've got examples. These are from national studies of the various health impacts that can happen in the area. So a lot of that has to do with air contamination from the whole industry. So you've got increased asthma, things like that. There's just so many impacts that can affect schools. So obviously any kind of water contamination, terrible for students, terrible for any human that has to deal with it. You've got issues you might not think about. Noise. These operations, especially when they're drilling, will go 24/7. They're extremely loud. That is, you know, obviously not great for a learning environment. So impacts like that, from serious environmental and public health to some of those that we might not think about as much, like noise.
I just always think about how a lot of times people who are pro for whatever questionable or issue is up, or the one that's being battled at the time, is until you bring the kids into it, and then you say, this is how it would hurt your kid.
Right.
And that's when a lot of times when people say, well, all right, wait a minute. Let me rethink that.
Yeah.
And if you were to say it would give your child asthma, it might, you know, there's a greater chance that it would bring about, you know, I don't know. I don't like saying these things because it makes always. I'm one of those people who says if you talk about it, that's what happens. You know, greater chance of leukemia, cerebral palsy, you know, but those sorts of things. And if you start saying that's what happens to the children when you put these things around, and that's, you know, then the people who have put pro fracking because it brings more jobs, and yeah. Then you question them.
I mean, I think you're right. These risks are there for all humans. I think it's one of our better features that we care about the next generation and we care about our kids a great deal. Sometimes that, unfortunately, is what it takes for the rubber to meet the road and people to say, I know those impacts that you said, they could be me, they could be my neighbors, any a number of adults, I know, but I'm still pro. Sometimes realizing that, you know, children are also going to be impacted is what it takes to wake people up and to motivate some to say, well, no, we've got to first acknowledge these risks. We've got to look at the science, admit there are risks, and then deal with them.
Let me ask you a question about the recent General Assembly.
Sure.
Correct? And we have some regulations from the recent General Assembly.
Yeah, if I can, I'll give you a little background about what led to the bills in General Assembly this year. So, as you know, there's different layers of regulation of, you know, any industry. So you've got your federal regulation, your state regulation, and then your local. In large part, our federal government is not regulating fracking to a great degree. It's been accepted from a lot of our environmental protection statutes. Virginia, at the next level down, Virginia has the Department of Mines, Minerals, and Energy. We've got the Virginia Gas and Oil Act. And we've got their regulations that address drilling in Virginia. That act specifically says that localities can still use their land use authority to address fracking and gas drilling in their communities. So for the past several years, those regulations, of course, like any others, need updated. Our regulations in Virginia were really rather weak and didn't even address fracking. So for several years, DMME led a process involving different stakeholders, including conservation community, industry, to update our regulations. We were very active throughout that process, saying we need to look at this issue and that issue and just working our hardest to make sure they were as strong as possible. We fought very hard to get those over the finish line, and I'm happy to report that in December of 2016, those regulations became effective, went into effect. One of the key features of the new regulations is a requirement for drillers to disclose the chemicals used in fracking. I'm sure you've heard about that being an issue across the nation. Folks want to know what is being injected underground, and ensure that their drinking water is safe, among other risks, but that's the big one. Virginia did not have that requirement until these regulations went into effect, and we do now. Now, the regulations said, hey, industry, you've got to disclose to DMME what chemicals you used. They dealt with what DMME would, you know, what they'll put on their website and what will be public. The presumption was that that information would be public. I'm getting to what happened with the bills, and the issue relates to trade secrets. So industry drillers often say, yes, we used, you know, 10 different chemicals, and either all of it or some of it or some component of it is a trade secret, meaning we've kept it secret, we have a competitive interest in keeping it secret, and we should not have to disclose it to the public. In the regulatory process, we looked at that is an interest we recognize, but we've got to balance that with disclosure, which was the goal, and making sure that the public and other agencies can look at the information they need. So that was decided that if someone submits and claims that it's a trade secret, DMME won't post it to their website. An issue we did not get into in that process was FOIA, the Freedom of Information Act. So what happens if a driller has submitted chemical information to DMME, including some trade secret information? DMME agrees it's a trade secret, and they get a FOIA request that says, tell us anyway. And we knew that that was something we were going to have to figure out after. It didn't come up in that process. We always envisioned that we would go through a similar process to look at the different issues and balance all of the interests. We've got interests in public health. We've got interests in protecting the environment and natural resources. Industry has an interest in protecting their trade secrets. So that was something we were going to have to carefully work through and come up with a solution that protected everyone as much as possible. What happened, and this happened last year, there were bills filed, and it happened again this year, is that industry, instead of getting together with the same stakeholders, with the state, and saying, we know we've got to craft some solution to deal with FOIA and these trade secrets, they filed or sought what we call FOIA exemptions. And I'll try to explain that simply, and that is FOIA basically says the public has a right to know what their state agencies are doing. So if someone in the public writes to you and asks for information, they need to give it to them. An exemption means that by statute, they've gone and said, well, there are certain protected types of information you don't have to disclose. It could be for any number of reasons. Here, they just said this should be a total exemption so that if it's a trade secret, if these chemicals are trade secret, it'll go into a black box that can't be accessed by the public. There were some emergency provisions in the regulations, but they don't get at, you know, non-emergency situations like if the Department of Environmental Quality or the Virginia Department of Health gets a request from a citizen saying, hey, I've got this problem. There was a frack job next door. Now the water in my well looks funny and smells funny. I'm very concerned about what was used. I'm not able to find out because they say it's a trade secret. I need you, as the state agencies tasked with protecting public health and the environment, I need you to make sure that we don't have a big problem here. Of course, you would want those state agencies to have access to the trade secret information so that they could say, you're right, we're going to look into it. We know what the chemicals are, and we're going to check your water and
figure out. So the government can do it, but the individuals cannot.
Well, with the fracking exemption that these bills sought, even the agencies couldn't have done it simply or efficiently. The bills would have just said, without any other consideration, this trade secret information goes into a black box that other government, they won't access it, you know, through a FOIA request, nor will citizens, nor will that well owner who's worried that, you know, his family's drinking water might have been contaminated. It would just automatically go in certain emergency situations they could release to emergency responders. That, of course, is far too late to deal with all of the risks. You know, we've got a lot that needs addressed outside of an emergency situation. And even in responding to an emergency, that's often too late to learn what the chemical is. Folks want to be able to plan what's been used in our community and what is our plan of how we'll respond to it. So there were some serious deficiencies with these bills. We worked hard. We talked to all kinds of folks. We talked to localities, government officials. We talked to citizens. We talked a lot to Governor McAuliffe's administration about this issue. And they agreed completely with us that the exemption is not proper. A total exemption was unacceptable. That we needed one, that we should always be able to access, the public should always be able to access what chemical, the name of the chemical being used. Often what companies really want to protect is the exact recipe of what they pumped into the ground. But at a minimum, we should always have access to the chemicals. We also agreed, administration and us and many, many others, that there should be an easy, efficient way for DEQ or the Virginia Department of Health to also learn this information. And that if they determine that there's an adverse impact, that they can then, you know, use that information and to address those risks to make sure that drinking water continues to be safe.
Sounds like the bill did not pass.
It it's such a convoluted process in Richmond. I'm sure you've probably followed different bills. It did not pass. The good news is it did not pass. There were two bills in the House and two bills in the Senate, and each set did the same thing. I would say we fought pretty long and hard throughout General Assembly. We fought very hard to try to talk to industry, to craft. I believe there were solutions available had there been any willingness to share the information with the agencies that needed that information to protect Virginians. There wasn't that willingness. So we fought first to talk and try to get there. When it was clear that they were not willing to share that information with our state agencies, we agreed that those bills as written were just unacceptable and did not protect Virginians or Virginia's natural resources. So those bills did not pass.
There was no opportunity to get them to change. They couldn't be rewritten for change.
That we tried. Yeah, we had a lot of meetings and calls and negotiations, and administration talked to them as well. And they weren't successful.
Was this bipartisan, or were they divided on which?
Bipartisan. Yeah. There was bipartisan opposal to the bills as written. So this was not a partisan issue, which makes sense. We're talking about, public health, drinking water, things that definitely cross the aisle. And we're glad that the legislators were just so glad that legislators throughout Virginia were able to see how critical this is and not get hung up on politics here.
1140, Kristen Davis from the Southern Environmental Law Center here as we're talking about fracking on the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, a beautiful, beautiful Sunday here in February, or maybe April or May, I can't tell, depending on the weather and the temperature. Kristen, I'm going to come back. I want to talk a little bit more about what's going on in Richmond.
Yeah.
So hang tight, folks. All right, back in action here on the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. Our guest, Kristen Davis, attorney at the Southern Environmental Law Center, specialist on fracking. Real quick, what other projects are you working on besides fracking?
I work on something we already talked about, which is National Forest Public Lands. I'm over in the George Washington and Jefferson National Forest quite a bit.
Is that just so you can hike? Is that did you ask for that?
I definitely asked for that, and am very glad to have meetings with Forest Service and other folks, sometimes actually in the forest. It's a great reminder of why we are working so hard to do this work, to be in those beautiful settings. So I work on that. There's lots of big projects playing out in the GW. They're collaborative. We work with a lot of other stakeholders to all of us trying to make sure that these projects achieve what our different groups want them to and stay away from what would be unacceptable. So spend a lot of time helping set up projects like that in the GW and hopefully more down on the Jefferson also. And I work on some general Virginia water quality issues outside of fracking. Definitely think of fracking as it's an energy issue and it's a water quality issue as well. And that's where I spend most of my time.
Well, thank you for your work. So we were talking about fracking in Richmond, but there are things outside of Richmond as well, right? Because you mentioned there's federal. We were talking about what goes on a federal level affect what had the decision that was made in the National Forest, the George Washington National Forest, and then just now talking about the bill not being passed in Richmond because you couldn't get it, I want to say tweaked, although it maybe needed to be more than tweaked to the wording that it needed to be.
Right.
And then on a local level, Augusta, sure, with its being the first county to ban.
That's right.
Fracking.
This past week, Augusta County is the first Virginia county. They have been looking at this issue because of they're over in the valley, and familiar with the GW issues that played out with will there be any additional drilling or acres available in the GW. And then there was a few years back, there was an application to drill in Rockingham County. So given that they're Marcellus Shale area, there's been a lot of awareness and concern and just work to look at this issue for years. Augusta County decided to go with a total prohibition or ban of fracking within the county. They also, so it's interesting because they said there's not going to be any fracking within the county. If you want to do traditional drilling, so kind of the old school, doesn't involve fracking, doesn't involve horizontal drilling, they also passed a couple of more stringent conditions for their special exception permit. So no fracking, but and some stronger protections in place if folks want to, you know, ever pursue traditional drilling.
Can you can make these decisions on the county level. Augusta can make that decision. But if Richmond were to say, you know, sorry, guys, the whole state can be fracked from here to there, mm-hmm. all the way from Virginia Beach to Bristol,
right.
frack away. Can the county say, well, so much for what we did back in February 2017?
You are right that, well, counties cannot conflict with state law. Now, that would require a drastic change to state law because, as I said earlier, the Virginia Gas and Oil Act specifically says that local land use authority applies. So the state with that in place, you know, that they can't do that. They would have to change that. And that would be a monumental undertaking. Of course, we would strongly oppose that. We think that local governments and citizens are in the perfect position to decide whether or not this should occur in their communities. There's lots of local concerns that need to be addressed. And, you know, the EPA's report that came out in 2016 specifically acknowledges that the impacts, you know, fortunately, fracking doesn't lead, you know, we aren't in a situation where 90% of frack jobs lead to total water contamination. Of course, that would just be disastrous. However, where it does occur, while it might not be so frequent, it is disastrous. Those impacts play out at the local level. It may provide comfort to some people to hear that we, you know, this state hasn't experienced or whatever state hasn't experienced a specific contamination issue. I can guarantee you, and I'm sure you understand, that for the people living in that community where their water was contaminated, it is their world. It is huge impacts and disastrous. So I think it makes all the sense in the world for these local communities to have the power and ability to look at the issue and decide what makes sense for them. In Richmond, something that played out was one legislator said, look, we are all spending, this was over in the Virginia Beach area, we're spending a fortune to protect our drinking water. The eastern parts of Virginia have groundwater management concerns, saltwater intrusion, and so they're doing all this work to protect their drinking water, protect the aquifers. They're taxed in terms of volume, in terms of water quantity and quality, and why in the world would we allow chemicals to be pumped into the ground that we don't know about that could contaminate it? Like that just makes no sense at all from an economic perspective. So anyway, I guess my point is that local communities have a lot to think about. And when they decide, hey, we want to move forward with it, but we want to make sure we address these risks the best we can, they can do that in Virginia through a prohibition, or they can act, and that's what Augusta County did, or they can develop different restrictions to address those risks. And that is what King George County, which is over above the Taylorsville Basin, in August of 2016, they passed an ordinance that left 91% of the county unavailable to fracking and also set up stringent framework of restrictions to help protect the area if there ever is industrial gas development.
Kristen Davis, attorney at the Southern Environmental Law Center, here on Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, talking about fracking. Kristen, so let's bring it right here, right close to home. Is this something that Albemarle County, an incredibly large county, has to worry about? Whether it's within the county itself, or as we're next door to Nelson County or Orange County, both of which either have a mine next to it or a pipeline possibly running through it. Is this something that Albemarle has to worry about?
You know, I think the counties and localities that are moving forward are the ones that have a concrete risk. So King George County knows that it's over the Taylorsville Basin and also knew that over 86,000 acres had been leased. So they had a very real concern in front of them. This would be a new industry, and we don't have anything in our ordinances to specifically address it. Augusta had all the history I went through with the GW and Marcellus Gas. So I think it makes sense that those counties are focused on it, and why counties like Albemarle, without those gas reserves underground, aren't. Because Lord knows these counties have so much they need to do and have to prioritize based on their most serious threats or priorities.
Right. So just a few minutes left in today's program with Kristen Davis from SELC. I feel like that I should talk about the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. And what I want to do is just realize, you know, that there's it's just a current events thing. And is this something, is this a topic that goes on at work? You know, is what's going on at SELC?
Absolutely.
You know, looking through the news to see that there's a new EPA administrator? Are you
absolutely
looking talking about whether or not what's going on there might undo some of the work that's already been done?
Yeah, we are very focused on this issue. I know citizens are, I know my friends are, I know other organizations are, and at SELC, we are definitely following what's happening at the federal level very closely. Lots and lots of analysis from our DC folks and meetings here. So that includes EPA and just other work in the Trump administration that kind of goes after the regulations that we all count on to help protect our environment. We had, in terms of the EPA, we had memos from Trump administration in January that froze grants, froze hiring, and for prohibited EPA employees from talking about that freeze. There was a bill in February, which, you know, isn't expected to go anywhere, that actually sought in one sentence to just terminate EPA by 2018. That's not realistic, thank goodness, but it's out there. And then, of course, the appointment of Pruitt to head up the EPA. He has been one of the EPA's most strident critics, has sued the EPA over 12 times, often at the behest of oil and gas industries. So, yes, these are all things that we follow very closely and strategize on a constant basis about what are the most serious risks for our organization specifically to address, for others, and what are we going to do? And we're doing that all the time. We talked about local and state protections, but we cover a lot of different areas, energy and, clean water, clean air. And in the absence of stronger local and state protections, we, like everyone else, we depend on the federal government for important common sense safeguards that'll help protect our economy, our communities, and our families.
Would, and I realize that this is guessing, but is there a fear that some change in EPA regulations would undo some of the work that's been put forth on fracking?
I guess maybe this is a blessing in disguise in some ways that there hasn't been a lot of federal regulation of fracking. There are certain areas, so on public land, so like the National Forest, not that it's playing out here, but there have been the Bureau of Land Management's, there was a methane rule, so that dealt with methane release from fracking operations on public land, as well as just a fracking rule. They developed rules to just regulate fracking where it occurs on public lands. So those have been in litigation for since their inception for a while now, and are in some settlement discussions now. But certainly there's concern about losing those rules. Beyond just EPA regulations, we worry about and we are fighting hard to protect what's in place. We've got landmark, longstanding environmental statutes like the Clean Water Act, like the Clean Air Act, that are to help ensure the safety of our communities that have been in place for about 50 years now. We know that taking back these protections will first and foremost hurt our most vulnerable citizens, children, retirees, anyone with limited means. So we are joining, I think, so many people in the American public saying that we aren't going to stand for the administration's efforts to dismantle those critical safeguards.
Do you, certainly over the last several months, there seems to be a lot more public protesting than there have been in decades past.
Yes.
Or at least a lot more coverage of public protesting. Would you disagree that this might, that public protesting might also fall to anything that related to the EPA that would be undone? If the EPA was undid some rules on Clean Water Act, or that public protesting might fall and be against those as well?
Are you asking if I think it has an impact, or
if Clean Water Act what is the rule about where you can dump coal dust in the streams.
Right, the Stream Protection
Rule. Stream Protection Act.
Yeah.
Stream Protection Rule.
Yeah.
If put forth at the right time, because I know a lot of these take place on Friday afternoons where they're released, that you can be done. Do you see where more public protesting might come forth to help the EPA?
I think absolutely. You know, we're jumping back and forth between statutes and regulations, and it probably means a lot to me as a lawyer, but not so much to other people. But what it plays into...
Thank you for covering me with that.
What it plays into is, we've got these separate branches of government. We've got our legislative and our executive. And so the agencies are executive and come up with regulations. Legislative come up with our statutes, like the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act. For both of those, I think it matters. The public showing up and making themselves heard so clearly, so loudly, in such numbers that they want these protections in place at a minimum. We want to go further, but at a minimum, we are not going to roll back on what we've fought for the past 50 years. Citizens showing up and telling their elected officials, do not do this, do not go down that path, is very important. They're the same legislators at the federal level who will vote on what to do with the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act. In terms of the different rules, I think for all of the same reasons, speaking to those officials, speaking to the Trump administration, and letting them know, fighting back before we lose rules like the Stream Protection Rule, which unfortunately we have now. But I think expressing outrage, fear, concern, all of it, all of the different, everything we're all feeling and calling our elected officials about is so important.
For general listeners out there, what can people do to help the SELC and to help you with fracking?
SELC, so we're a nonprofit organization. We rely on donors, and folks are extremely generous. And we appreciate that, and it's what lets us keep working. So there's always that. We appreciate just running into people and hearing that they appreciate our work. We're just people who work long, hard hours, and everyone likes to know that it's appreciated. I, above all, would just ask people to stay engaged, stay informed, whether you're following us on social media or our website, us and a bunch of other organizations, just stay engaged, stay informed. Don't give up. There is so much that we can do. We are working every day, and I go home in my personal life and, you know, make the calls that I can and send the letters I can. But whatever we're all doing, we can make a difference. So don't give up.
SELC.org, correct?
I think it's southernenvironment.org, www.southernenvironment.org.
Kristen Davis from the Southern Environmental Law Center. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much, Rick.
All right. Next week, Sean McCord will be here talking about the Festival of the Book. Thanks so much.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake-Up Call, only on WPVC LP Charlottesville.